to be on Glensy. The octopus's garden be the shape.
Hello, I'm Jim Falzerano. It's Thursday, the 10th of September. Coming up in today's Guardian Daily, Obama's big speech on health care.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. It's not true.
After 4 years in jail, Liverpool fan Michael Shields gets a royal pardon.
I would like to say a massive thank you to all the people out there, including Liverpool and Everton fans, who've supported me and my family over the last 4 years. Thanks to you, I knew I'd never walk alone.
And we look at the implications for the media after a soldier dies as a British reporter is rescued in Afghanistan.
From The Guardian's own experience, when our then correspondent in Baghdad, Rory Carroll, was kidnapped a few years ago, we actually weren't in control of the situation and things were going on that we couldn't determine, we couldn't control, and that's clearly what's happened in this case too.
Have Apple uncovered the latest must-have gadgets in their latest launch? And you may have recognized a bit of them a moment ago. The Beatles are making a comeback, sort of. But first, Bill Overton with the news and a review of today's papers.
Barack Obama continued his battle for healthcare reform last night, telling the United States Congress that he's determined to be the last president to take up the cause. America's divided over the reforms and debates been raging at town hall meetings across the country. He wants every American to have health insurance, but his Republican opponents believe it'll be too expensive and involve too much government interference. Polls are showing support for the president and his healthcare plan slipping. The main opposition candidate in the Afghan elections claimed the people counting the vote are being manipulated by the incumbent president, Hamid Karzai. Abdullah Abdullah has said the election's being stolen from the Afghan people and the Independent Election Commission is anything but independent. Mr. Karzai now has over half of the votes, meaning he doesn't have to face a second round. A truck packed with explosives has been detonated in a Kurdish village in northern Iraq, killing at least 17 people, Iraqi police say. About another dozen people, including women and children, have been injured and a number of houses destroyed. And England won a resounding 5-1 victory against Croatia last night, securing their place in the 2010 World Cup finals in South Africa. Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard scored two each, and there's also one from Wayne Rooney. Now let's take a look at today's papers. The death of a British soldier during a raid to rescue a journalist in Afghanistan is the story most are interested in. Questions over bloody raid is our headline, reporting claims that British forces acted while talks to release the men were still underway. New York Times journalist Stephen Farrell, who has dual British and Irish nationality, is now free, but his Afghan translator was killed in the raid. And the Times quotes anonymous sources in Kabul who describe the commando-led operation as heavy-handed. The Telegraph claims the army are angry that a soldier died after Farrell allegedly ignored advice not to travel to the Taliban-controlled area. The Mail focuses on the post strike, leading with the news that tens of millions of letters are sitting undelivered following rolling strikes by postal workers. The backlog in London alone could run to 20 million items. 20,000 Royal Mail workers are on strike over cost-cutting plans. And England's victory has pride of place on the front page of The Sun as the paper urges readers to get De Beers in a celebration of all things South African. There's more news and sport updated all day at guardian.co.uk.
With the pressure mounting on Barack Obama from the right and the left, the president addressed the nation last night to make his case for health care reform. First, we have an excerpt from Obama's speech, and then The Guardian's Washington bureau chief, Ewan McGaskill, gives us his reaction.
I'm not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined to be the last. The time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care. I believe a broad consensus exists for the aspects of the plan I just outlined. Consumer protections for those with insurance, an exchange that allows individuals and small businesses to purchase affordable coverage, and a requirement that people who can afford insurance get insurance. And I have no doubt that these reforms would greatly benefit Americans from all walks of life, as well as the economy as a whole. Still, given all the misinformation that's been spread over the past few months, I realize that many Americans have grown nervous about reform. So tonight I want to address some of the key controversies that are still out there. Some of people's concerns have grown out of bogus claims spread by those whose only agenda is to kill reform at any cost. The best example is the claim made not just by radio and cable talk show hosts, but by prominent politicians, that we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens. Now, such a charge would be laughable if it weren't so cynical and irresponsible. It is a lie, plain and simple. There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. It's not true. I understand that the politically safe move would be to kick the can further down the road, to defer reform one more year, or one more election, or one more term. But that is not what this moment calls for. That's not what we came here to do. We did not come to fear the future. We came here to shape it. I still believe we can act, even when it's hard.
I'm Ewan McCaskill, Washington Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Last night's healthcare speech in front of a joint session of Congress comes after a long summer of polarizing debate in this country. And the speech last night showed just how raw and emotional this debate continues to be. It was an extraordinarily sort of raucous and noisy session of Congress. Normally, presidents are treated with respect. They're as a head of state. But Obama was greeted by one senator who heckled him. He said, "You lie." I've never come across anything like that in the time I've been covering US politics. It shows the extent to which Democrats and Republicans are divided in this issue and the chances of the two getting together to produce a joint bill seem increasingly unlikely. Obama's main aim here was to try and win back ground after a terrible summer in which he sort of lost momentum for health reform. His plans have been sort of savaged at town hall meetings across America. And to some extent, he did that. It was a very passionate speech. It was a fighting speech. He took on his critics. He accused the Republicans of scare tactics. He spoke about lies that had been peddled about death panels. I mean, Obama, throughout, when he was campaigning, was given over to moderation. So this was an unusual for him, a fighting speech, a partisan speech. His sort of failure to reach out to the Republicans suggests that he's given up on a sort of bipartisan approach. And it seems to me that he's intent now on just trying to win over and unite the Democratic Party. He's got to win over those Liberal Democrats, and he's got to win over sort of fiscally conservative Democrats who are sceptical about the health reform, costing millions, billions more at a time when the country can't afford it.
For more on Obama's speech, go to guardian.co.uk/America. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website, Maeve Kennedy picks through the UK locations hoping to become the next city of culture. Get all the details at guardian.co.uk/culture. How one man's hunt for his son's killer led to self-imposed exile from Pakistan. For that one, go to guardianweekly.co.uk. And a big night for both England's and Scotland's World Cup ambitions. There's full analysis on our Football Weekly podcast with James Richardson, Paul Doyle, and Kevin McCara at guardian.co.uk/footballweekly.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
What's that coming over the hill? It's Football Weekly Live, a special stream show beaming from near-Earth orbit into your computer at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 20th of September. Ooh. That day, of course, is the Manchester Derby and the Chelsea Spurs ding-dong affair. And as such, Football Weekly will be on hand to recycle other people's opinions as our own, even faster than usual, on all the day's big talking points. We'll have, as ever, a panel of top Guardian writers on hand. We'll have views from the grounds, and we'll have Sid Lowe phoning it in from Spain. You can chip in too, using the message boards or various other methods of communication, email, Twitter, or that SMS messaging business. That's Football Weekly, Sunday the 20th of September at 6 p.m. live. What could possibly go wrong?
It's a hard thing to be locked away for a crime you did not commit. I was just 18 when I was arrested. I'm now 22 and face having to rebuild a life which was shattered by the failure of two legal systems, one here in the UK and one in Bulgaria.
A statement there being read out on behalf of Liverpool football fan Michael Shields, who is now a free man. Convicted in 2005 in Bulgaria for attempted murder, Shields had been serving the remainder of his sentence in the UK before being pardoned by the Justice Secretary, Jack Straw.
During the meeting on the 28th of August with Mr. Shields' parents, important new evidence came to light, which, when looked alongside all the previously available evidence, has now satisfied me that Mr. Shields meets the high test set for me by the court.
The Guardian's North of England correspondent Martin Wainwright's been getting reaction from Shields' supporters.
I'm with Arlene McCarthy, the MEP who's pursued this case tremendously, gone all the way to Bulgaria, seen the president, haven't you? And you were just saying you had a bottle of champagne in your office for several years, which you've now handed over.
I have, yeah.
But not everybody's sharing in the joy. I mean, I was listening to the radio this morning, there's a lot of unease about the way this has happened, and people even talking about the election and saying, you know, Labour looking to build up its support in the northwest. What do you say to...
Well, I know, and I can understand why people might say that, because, you know, it's unprecedented. It's a historic decision to pardon someone. But, you know, I think the key issue is, had it been just political, well, frankly, we could have done it before the last local election in Liverpool, where we're hoping to gain control back. We could have done it before my European election. And, you know, I had a conversation with Jack Straw where he said to me he would not make a decision around an election time, and the decision would be taken on advice of lawyers and a legal team.
I'm a pastor and not a lawyer, and therefore I tread very carefully when talking about legal niceties. I think Jack Straw has already acknowledged that this whole process does need to come under review, because I understand the public anxieties. One of the things that frustrated me as a pastor was the falling between the two stools of the Bulgarian legal system and the UK legal system. There just seemed to be at one stage a passing of the buck between one and the other. So I understand people's anxieties. I think this does need to come under legal review, and I would support that.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The freeing of a British reporter who had been captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan has led to the deaths of his translator and a British soldier. This, of course, raises issues for the media, including The Guardian. To discuss this, we've gathered Harriet Sherwood and Peter Beaumont in the studio. Harriet is head of international news for The Guardian and sends our reporters to dangerous locations around the world. And Peter, who's the Observer's foreign affairs editor, knows what it's like to report from the war zone. First to Peter. You actually went to school with the captured reporter, Stephen Farrell. How much of a risk taker is he?
I mean, Steve takes risks like everyone does. But, I mean, Steve, I think, he's an extremely driven individual, but he's also an extremely careful individual. And I don't think he will have set off on this trip in which he ran into trouble without considering what the consequences were likely to be.
Okay, now, Harriet, when you read stories like this, the rescue, especially the rescue by military forces over a reporter, what kinds of things go through your head considering that you have to send reporters to very dangerous locations?
Well, of course, my blood runs cold. It's a nightmare scenario for any reporter out on the front line, but also for the editors back on the desks. It's what you dread. Your first concern, obviously, is for the safety of your own reporter, but you obviously also have a great deal of concern for anybody who might be with him or her. In this case, Steve's translator was with him and was tragically killed in the rescue attempt. And then, of course, a British soldier was killed too. So it was obviously a very, very big gun battle. And I think the other thing that's very revealing about this situation is that, as far as I understand it, the New York Times had no forewarning that this rescue attempt was to take place. And I think from The Guardian's own experience when our then correspondent in Baghdad, Rory Carroll, was kidnapped a few years ago, we realised that although we felt that he was our man, we actually weren't in control of the situation and things were going on that we couldn't determine, we couldn't control, and that's clearly what's happened in this case too.
Is there a danger when you have the military involved in rescuing journalists that for the Afghan people, the distinction between the media and the military, which we think of as an absolute distinction, does that break down?
I think it's very difficult. I mean, in this case, there are unconfirmed reports that civilians were killed in the gun battle too, women and children. And I think that it is likely to inflame anti-Western feeling among the population of Afghanistan.
Peter, you referred in your piece to the God of News and the very stringent requirements that the God of News imposes on its disciples. What kinds of sacrifices are acceptable if you're going to be a worshipper of the God of News?
I mean, it's a concept that Steve came up with on a long drive. I mean, his journalism is his life, and he would always put it almost before absolutely everything else. And if he feels that a story is so important that it needs to be done, I think he will always try to find a way of doing it. And I recall at the beginning of the war in Iraq, just before the invasion happened, how, you know, Steve was looking at absolutely every possible avenue that could get him to the story. And, you know, it's just the kind of person he is. I mean, he feels as though it's a duty to tell these stories. And I think that's what he would have considered when he was thinking about going to Kunduz and in trying to work out how to do it as safely as possible.
And Harriet, for you, in this incredibly competitive business that we're in, are there any limits?
Of course there are. I think that it's very important to set limits and to be clear about limits. And I don't think that, I mean, there are many stories that need energetic, committed reporters like Steve following them. But in the end, there's no story that's worth paying the price of life for.
Do you think the armed forces would have gone in if the reporter was just a British citizen?
My feeling on that is that the British forces take the view that it's a British citizen that needs rescuing. Do you think that's right, Peter?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I kind of feel as though Steve probably wouldn't have expected the cavalry to come charging over the hill. I mean, he would have been using his own resources to get out, but that's not necessarily the view shared by the powers that be.
I guess the other question is, this is a New York Times reporter, so maybe was there some pressure put on the British by the Americans to, we just don't know.
No, we don't know, and I think, again, from past experience, both the Guardian's own experience and other newspapers, you never quite unravel the full details of what's happened.
Harriet Sherwood and Peter Beaumont. Still to come, twisting and shouting on Oxford Street. But first...
Hi there, I'm John Crace, feature writer at The Guardian. I'm appropriately enough in the post room because today the Royal Mail, the country's largest, or certainly one of the largest employers with 176,000 employees, has signed up to the 10-10 campaign. That is the environmental campaign to persuade people to reduce the UK's emissions by 10% in the year 2010. The Royal Mail, I think, is a real coup, partly because it is such a large organisation and it's relatively easy for smaller businesses to commit to that. But getting so many people on board and such a huge logistics, for instance, at the moment the Royal Mail has COT emissions of, which would fill 71 billion party balloons per year, apparently, and their road mileage is the equivalent to a return trip to Jupiter. So it is a huge, huge operation. Most importantly, I think they are going to work on their own employees and their business customers to get them involved and to think about how they use the Royal Mail in terms of kind of packaging and what they do at home as well. So it's what they're doing is not just going to be restricted to the Royal Mail. Hopefully it will have a kind of ripple effect far beyond that as well. And if you want to find out more about the 10-10 campaign, you can go to The Guardian's website, www.guardian.co.uk/10-10.
Bobby Johnson, The Guardian's technology correspondent, has been to one of Apple's secretive yet much-hyped briefings in San Francisco. It's been holding a September product launch for several years now, nearly always with new iPods. But what has the company unveiled? Is there new hardware? Did Steve Jobs appear in public? Bobby, put us out of our misery.
Product announcements by Apple are usually surrounded by a host of rumors and a mild sense of hysteria. And yesterday's launch event in San Francisco was no different. The company's legion of fans had already predicted everything from an appearance by the Beatles to the company's long-awaited touchscreen computer. Instead, however, the crowd gathered at the event were treated to something that few dared to expect: the return of the company's chief executive, Steve Jobs. Taking to the stage in California, the 54-year-old, who secretly received a liver transplant this spring following complications caused by pancreatic cancer, made his first public appearance since this time last year. Receiving a rapturous welcome from the crowd and smiling throughout a standing ovation, he spoke about the life-saving surgery that he'd received. Just months after the procedure, and dressed in his trademark black top and blue jeans, Jobs looked very thin, but the emphatic message was that he was back in charge. He gave a nod to his team of executives, but with just a few words, he made it clear that he was now back running the show. As for what he actually unveiled, well, that was a little more pedestrian. Alongside new iTunes software and some price cuts, the big news was that the iPod Nano now sports a video camera, pedometer, and built-in FM radio that will surely cement its place as the world's most popular digital music player. But that was it. No new iPods, no Beatles, and definitely no tablet computer. For Apple's hardcore fans, however, seeing Steve Jobs back in action will have been all the good news they were looking for. And you can read more about the announcements with our report and an investigation into the future of the iPod at guardian.co.uk/technology.
I'd like to be
in case you are wondering what that noise was at the beginning of the podcast, it was a rendition of Octopus's Garden by fans buying the new Beatles Rock Band game. The Guardian's Peter Walker went along to music and video store HMV on London's Oxford Street. He's been speaking to those queuing to be among the first to get their hands on the game.
I think I just kind of grew up with the music, so my mum was a big fan, and you know, when you're growing up and listening to that music, and sometimes you kind of pick it up and it's kind of just feels very kind of natural and very kind of homely, really.
Some people say that young people are spending so long on these kind of games and not actually learning any real instruments and forming bands. Do you think there's anything to that, or do you think the one can lead on to the other?
Yeah, I mean, it can, but I don't really know if it needs to particularly. I mean, the sort of argument that I use is that people that play like FIFA and that sort of stuff, it's not sort of detracting them from playing football. I think there's sort of, there can be sort of chance for both. It's not as if kids like us are going to be able to be on stage in front of thousands of people, but it gives the sort of the experience of what that might have been like.
Me being just 19, I've only really listened to contemporary music, but I think this has kind of opened the doors to listening to music that I wasn't, you know, able to listen to before.
Which other bands have you got into?
The Police, a lot. Like, since playing Rock Band 1, I bought all the albums.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I really like The Police, yeah.
Peter Walker, not sure if this is him singing. Today's podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, Glenn Austin Anderson, and Tim Mabey. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.